get ready for this next talk. So, little disclosure of conflict of interest. I actually work for the Open Home Foundation, the people that make Home Assistant. And as we are gathering, thank you. As we are conquering the world with our solution, we thought it was a good idea to ask these people to hack the hell out of our competitors. No, that's not the case. But anyway, I hope you will enjoy the story by Dan Keuper and Thijs Alkemade and explain how they hacked the hell out of this smart hub machine and learn something from that. So without further ado, another round of applause. Thank you.
Thanks. So, welcome. Yeah, so my name is Dan Keuper. I'm the head of security researcher, and I have with me my colleague Thijs, also security researcher in our team. So we work for Computests, which is a security provider in the Netherlands. We do pen testing, red teaming, incident response, etc. But we also have a dedicated research team where we conduct security research that we hope serves a public interest. And all the research we do, then we publish about and speak at conferences, etc. And we also frequently help out, for example, in active police investigations. So this is not the first talk we did on this conference. This is the third talk, so we are a bit tired. They're all about various pwn2own entries that we did. So if you're interested in us hacking routers or EV chargers, please watch back one of our other talks. Because this one is going to be about a smart hub that we actually didn't hack during the competition. So a little bit of background about pwn2own for those who are unfamiliar. Pwn2own is a competition, hacking competition, set out by the Zero Day Initiative. And they have three competitions per year where they set out specific targets, and you're entitled to, or you're encouraged to, research any of those targets, find zero days in one of those targets, and demonstrate that live on stage. And if so, there is a reward in a form of a cash prize. So they have to be true zero days for them to be eligible. They have a disclosure after your entry, and they will contact the vendor if they have an active communication channel with the vendor, or they will look if they are aware of the bug, and if it's indeed a true zero day, then you get some points and some money. So one of the islands is the pwn2own edition, which is about IoT devices. So it's about smart hubs, but also printers, IP cameras, etc., etc. We did participate in this competition with what we call a solo smash hub. That meant that we first hacked a router on the WAN side and then pivoted to a NAS on the inside, which is a specific category for pwn2own. There was also a smart hub category, and these were the targets. The one of the targets was the AOTech smart hub, which is maybe a little bit less familiar, but the other ones are pretty standard devices like an Apple HomePod, a Google Nest, etc. And if you manage to compromise one of those devices via a remote vector with a zero day, then you get a 60,000 euros. Except for the AOTech smart hub, then you only get 40,000. So the AOTech is cheaper, which usually reveals that CDI already has a suspicion that the device is less secure than their competitors. Maybe because it's a lesser known brand, why they set it to 40K. So we saw this category and we thought, okay, let's give it a go. Let's buy this AOTech to see what's what. So this is the device. It comes with Ethernet connectivity, but also with Wi-Fi, and it has Zigbee and Z-Wave support as well. So and you use it as a smart hub, so it communicates with all your Zigbee Z-Wave devices or over IP, and you can control them, all your devices, smart home devices, with an app. So the reason why we chose the AOTech over the other targets is, for us, we thought, okay, there is a large attack surface. And you have many radio protocols. You have Ethernet, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, etc. Can all be vulnerable, of course. So there is a lot of room for error. The other one is that for us, the vendor was unknown. There was no prior research published, so we thought, okay, maybe this is a new device. Not much people have looked at it, so we can find some vulnerabilities. But it turned out we were wrong. Also, it turned out that AOTech is not an unknown vendor. It's just a daughter company of Samsung. So basically, they use the full Samsung stack for their devices. So that meant that our previous assumptions were completely off. So what we thought was we just order a device, we open it up, we get the firmware, then we do something, and then we have profits. That was the initial plan. If you are here to see the profits, I'm afraid I have to disappoint you, because we only obtained the firmware, and that's what the whole talk is about, because that was a whole project in itself. And once we got the firmware, we had no time left to actually find vulnerabilities in the device before the competition started. But we decided to give this presentation anyway, because I think the method on how we actually obtained the firmware is still really, really interesting or relevant for other security researchers and might learn something that you can also apply to other devices. So this talk will just be about us saying, okay, these are the things we tried, this worked, this didn't work, etc., until we get a code exec on the device, but unfortunately not remotely via some cool vulnerability. So let's start with ordering the device and opening it up. This turned out to be problematic already. There are no easy screws or something to unscrew. So we had to break open the device. There was some blood on our hands. We're not going to return this or sell this on Marktplaats, saying, oh, it's slightly used. We properly destroyed the case for this. So that was already 2 hours of work before we had the device open. So that should have meant something for the rest of the research, I suppose. So, but this is the inside of the device. It has many components. We spent some time on identifying what the various components were. It has an NXP chip, an ARM CPU. It has an eMMC, which becomes relevant later on for obtaining the firmware. It has some chip for Wi-Fi, USB, etc., etc. There's also a pad on the top left, which is unused, maybe for a threat radio or something, but we don't really know. So now we have mapped the hardware. Let's see what happens on the software side to see if we can get an easy shell to extract the firmware. So typically what we do is we find a UART pin on the board to say, okay, and then we just break U-boot, or maybe there is a login prompt without a password. That's something easy. Well, it turned out we were lucky. It just has UART labeled. We just soldered some pins to it, connected to our machine, and see if we can get output. Well, we do. We see output, but it was locked down. Like, we couldn't log in, or we couldn't break U-boot, etc. It would out-boot automatically. And also, it mentions something about Lux encryption, which means that the firmware is encrypted, or at least part of the firmware is most likely encrypted. Which also means that dumping the EMC might give us only encrypted data. There were some other pins that we also identified, which will become relevant later. And those were a pin called B0 and B1. Once you look into the CPU schematics, you see that they have pins for selecting the boot mode. And if you put B0 too high, for example, you then boot, and the CPU will boot in something that typically would allow you to write firmware over USB serial interface to the device, and then it will boot that instead of the normal EMCC. The problem, of course, here is that we couldn't get that to work, and also we don't have validly signed firmware that we can send to the CPU to actually boot. But those pins were interesting and will become relevant later. So let's see then. We didn't get anywhere with the UART communication so far. We cannot extract the firmware, we cannot log in. So we have to read the EMMC. So yeah, that's what I just mentioned. So we have to dump the EMMC. This can be very easy or very hard, depending on what kind of chip they use and what kind of connectivity they have. In this case, it's pretty hard. Well, let me first tell you, you have two options when you want to dump some flash. The first one is to desolder the chip and then just read it externally in a hardware reader. Or the other one is do it in circuit. So just let the chip on the device and try to find some traces, connect some cables, and try to read the chip directly on in circuit. So on the AOTEX Smart Hub, the EMMC is a ball grid array. And for desoldering, that would mean that you have to use a heat gun to melt the balls that are on the underside of the chip, to melt those, and you can extract the chip, and then you can read it in a reader. But then you have to put it back on to boot the device. Or we had to buy two, which was an easier solution. would have been easier, but typically you would need to resolder that. You need special equipment for this, and it is very error prone. The chances of this failing and breaking the chip are very high. We tried this a couple of times with other devices, and I think we broke almost all of them. We are also not really hardware experts. Much of this research was also done by our former colleague, Khaled Nassar, who isn't here today. He was more specialized in this, but even he said, okay, we're not going to do this. We're not going to desolder this chip and resolder it again. So that leaves us with the second option, and that is to read it in circuits. That means that we must power up the chip. But we must make sure that the CPU doesn't communicate with the chip on the same time, because otherwise we are trying to read data from the EMMC, but if the CPU is also powered, it will also try to communicate with the EMMC, and then everything will fail. So we need to find a way to power the chip, but not the CPU, or make sure that the CPU doesn't read the chip while we are trying to read it. So we might have to cut some traces, cut some lines on the board so that the CPU and the chip cannot communicate with each other. And the other thing that we need is that we need to have the pins accessible. So the pins are on the backside of the underside of the flash chip. So we need to find a way to access those pins to actually read the read out the chip. So we spent some time to map out the various pins on the board. Some of them are labeled here. Until eventually we found the lines that were necessary. And so we scratched off some of the vias to actually be able to access them. So remove the solder mask so we can actually connect to those pins. So you put on some probes on those pins and see if you can get data using a logical analyzer. Well, that worked. We have a signal. So we have properly identified some of the chips that we need to communicate with the flash chip. Yeah, from here, we can say, okay, then the chip layout must be like this. So we now know where the pins are, and we can scratch off some more until we have all the lines that we need. So the protocol uses a clock line, a command line, and 8 data lines, but we only found 3. The other ones are on the other side of the board and very hard to reach, meaning that we cannot use all the 8 data pins that would typically be needed to read the flash. We only have 3. So we thought, okay, let's do it with only 1-bit communication, so only use the first data line to read out the chip. But there were some problems with this as well. The EMMC needs a 20 megahertz clock signal, which is reasonably fast, and it runs on 1.8 volts. Most devices we have run on 5 volt or 3.3 volts, but we needed something that runs on 1.8 volts to not burn the chip. And we need something reasonably fast so it can keep up with the clock signal that the EMMC expects. So, of course, you can buy specific equipment for this, but we thought, okay, what else do we have in the lab that would allow us to read the EMMC? So we have a Bus Pirate 5. which have no MMC peripheral, which means everything needs to be done in software, and that is slow. So it won't be fast enough to keep up with the 20 megahertz requirement for the EMC. The other chip we had laying at hand was an ESP32. It has an EMC peripheral driver, so in theory this should work. It only outputs 3.3 volts, so we need to have a level shifter to convert that to 1.8 volts, see if that works. So it didn't for us. It was very unreliable, unstable, didn't work. We think it's because the level shifter is too slow, but we didn't really know, but we didn't get any data. So we had to find another solution. So as I mentioned, the requirements are a bit tricky. We need a component that has a 20 megahertz clock signal and has a hardware peripheral for EMMC, and the 1.8 volt level that is rare because most devices will output 3.3 volts. So we looked around in the lab, and the lab at that moment was a gigantic mess of components everywhere, wires everywhere. We had a lot of old hardware from previous research and all kinds of components in various states. We spent some time digging through all that mess to see, do we have a board that matches these requirements? Where some boards we couldn't even identify what they were, what we actually used them for, etc. Until we found a Nucleo board, which we once bought to do power analysis to or power fault injection, power glitching on another device. We never implemented that, but we had two of those devices laying around. It is designed for 3.3 volts, but if you actually read the MCU specification doc, it mentions that it can run on 1.8 volt as well. That means we need to externally power the board, because if you typically power the board, it will use 3.3 volts. But by cutting some traces and directly powering the board or the CPU itself, we could make it to run on 1.8 volts. We just had to underclock the CPU a bit to make this work. And luckily for us, it has an MMC peripheral, so it would also be fast enough to do this. So we connected everything up. We had to fight with the Hall libraries for this chip for a couple of days because everything broke, nothing worked. That was also a problem later on when we rerun to write data. Also didn't work. I think the libraries are maybe broken by design, or I don't know. We did something wrong, but everything we tried failed. Until at some point we had actually... we could actually receive data. It was relatively slow because we were only using one data line, but it worked. So as I mentioned, you must make sure that when you power the AOTech, the flash chip, that the CPU doesn't communicate with the AOTech or with the flash chip, because then everything will break. So initially what we did was we set that boot mode B0 up high, so it would go in an alternative boot mode where it would wait for a communication over serial to get new firmware. We thought that would work, and then the CPU would no longer communicate with the EMC, so we could dump it. But then we found out that there is a watchdog timer, so after a certain amount of time, it will say, okay, it didn't receive new firmware over serial, and it would start reading the flash chip again to boot. So eventually what we did was we just cut the clock and CMD line from the CPU to the EMC, so it could no longer communicate. So once we did all that, which took I think 2 weeks or so, we were actually able to read the user area and the boot partition. So on to vulnerability analysis, or maybe not. Thijs?
Yeah, not yet, because as Daan mentioned before, there were these partitions, these Lux encrypted partitions, which includes also the root file system of the device. So with the access that we had, We could dump some things, but the actual root partition which has most of the firmware was not yet available for us. So this is kind of what we dumped from this from the EMMC. So we have the separate boot partitions, which are a separate section of the EMMC. That's two copies of U-boot. It's pretty standard U-boot here. We have a FAT32 partition on the left, which has four files on it, standard.fit, standard.fit.old, recovery.fit, and recovery.fit.old. And we have this LVM container, which contains those Lux encrypted partitions. There are four of them. One is the root partition, one is for the user data, like your own configuration. There's the golden one for in case you do like a factory reset of the device. And a factory, which I think is for the recovery mode. So those FIT images, what does a FIT image look like? So this is something that's implemented in U-boot. This is like one file that combines a kernel, a Linux kernel, with the init realm fs, so the initial file system. It has a device tree and like kernel arguments and stuff like that. And they can be signed. So these are signed by like a key that AOTech has, so that like they have a secure boot, so you cannot just run your own bootloader on the device. And these images, because they are signed, but they are not encrypted. So we could read them, we could instruct the kernel and the RAMFS from those images, and we could start analyzing those to see if there are any vulnerabilities there. So this is kind of what we gathered about how the boot process works. It starts out with a bootloader in ROM, which loads U-boot from the EMMC. That loads the standard.fit, and that actually loads two different things here. There's the secure world where it loads OptiE. This is like the trust zone in ARM as a secure world. And then there's the normal world where it has the Linux kernel and the init RAMFS and that sort of stuff. And then that init script in that init RAMFS, that actually sets up those Lux partitions. So it gets a key from the secure world, it uses that to decrypt the Lux images and then mounts them and can continue booting. So you have the key stored in the secure world, which should not be available to us. And if everything works correctly, we should not be able to get access to those Lux partitions. So we thought, what can we change here? So those FIT images are on a FAT32 partition, which has no signature or whatever. So the FAT images themselves are signed, but the entire partition is not. So if we do something with those images, we could like rename one to the other because it's the same signatures from the same key. We could swap them out or modify things here. And as I mentioned, there are four of them. There's the standard and there's the recovery. Both of those also have an older version. And the version numbers that AOTech assigned to those are like 3.33 for the newest ones and 3.12 for the old ones, which is quite a bit older. It might be due to the fact that we just unpacked it, updated it probably once we turned it on, but it hasn't gone through like a loop of various updates. And all of them are validly signed. All of them could be booted with the same key. As I said, we can just rename them because they all use the same certificate to be signed. And then we could manipulate, at least switch to a different one. So how does this Lux functionality fit within like secure boot? Well, really it doesn't, because Lux is encryption, it's not authentication. And encryption and authentication are not the same thing. So just encrypting something does not mean that somebody cannot modify it. And that's something that we started to investigate here. Might it be possible for us to modify something about those Lux images without breaking this way the setup works? So all of these images, they're all encrypted in the same way. Your user data and the root partition are all encrypted with the same key they got from the OptiE. That's done by this shell script here. I don't know if it's really readable for you, but it echoes a key and it pipes it into a tool called Crypt Setup. And that's the tool you use typically on Linux to mount a Lux encrypted partition. And the way that this works is it calls into Opt2E, as I mentioned, to get that encryption key. It's another shell script. It's called getKey. And that is passed on to crypt setup, which then reads and validates the Lux file system. But the way Lux actually works on the Linux with the crypt setup tool is that crypt setup is not actually doing any of the decryption itself. The way Lux works is it just hands everything over to the kernel and tells the kernel, please go, here's a key, here's some encrypted data, mount this as a disk image. So the encryption algorithms that you can use with Lux are not determined by the crypt setup tool. They're determined by what your kernel has implemented as encryption algorithms. And when we scrolled through that list to see what kind of functionality there was, we saw, hey, we can just select a null cipher and then just create an image that is not encrypted with any key. So we thought, well, can we just swap out the root file system with a Lux encrypted partition that's encrypted with a null key, and really just continue booting with our own root file system, because that would gain us arbitrary code execution on the system. It was a nice idea, and we tried to analyze, is this going to work? And then, sadly, we discovered it will not. Because crypt setup has a check if you try to use the null cipher, but you also pass the key, then it's refusing to boot. It's going to say, yeah, that key doesn't, you pass the key, but you don't need a key. This doesn't make any sense. I'm going to throw an error. And if that error is thrown, then the init script will just fail and will not continue booting. Okay, sad, that didn't work. But we did think that check was a bit suspicious, like a stir, it's looking, is there a cipher null anywhere in the string? Why is it doing that? It doesn't really make much sense, like what kind of things are they expecting here? It gave us a hunch that maybe this check wasn't so robust as we might initially think. So we thought, we're going to look at the commit history for this file on, I think, GitLab or whatever that the crypt setup uses. And then we noticed that there's an older version, and there the check is just stir compare. So just literally comparing, is the string cipher null? So the first check is way more strict. If this cipher null is anywhere in the string, then it refuses. And this one is way less strict. If it's just literally cipher null, then it will refuse. And this is actually the version that was in the older standard.fit. So the standard.fit.old and the recovery.fit.old had this same check still in there. So all we had to do is find a cipher name that if we passed, that would pass this check. But if you pass it to the kernel, it would use a null cipher. And that turned out to be quite easy as well, because it normally combines a cipher with a block cipher mode, so typically like CBC, or in cipher null case it's ECB, because there's no cipher mode at all. So the algorithm that it actually selects is like cipher null dash ECB. But if we just named it cipher null dot dash ECB, then we would pass the less strict check, so the check in the older version, and it would accept our image. So the steps for performing this attack. We had to swap out the standard.fit with the older version, so had to rename those files, which was allowed because this FAT32 partition is not signed. It's just the images themselves that are signed. Then we had to change the root partition, and we can just put anything we want in there. We can just make our own codes to run and put it in that partition. And we had to set the cipher to cipher null dash ECB, which is not standard by default there. We just hex added it into the Lux file system. And this way the check in that older version of crypt setup that was in our older standard.fit image would be bypassed, and the image would be mounted as a cipher null volume with our own arbitrary code. Okay, we had a nice idea, but now we had to actually write that into the eMMC to get this to work. And that, again, took us into the terrible mess that the STML abstraction layer, whatever. We spent a few hours on this, and then at some point we just gave up and tried something else, and that worked instantly. We switched to MicroPython, which... we could compile quite easily for this STM32, despite the fact that we were underclocking it. And this worked almost immediately, like just connect it, start writing. It was still quite slow. We had to really keep track. We want to write just these blocks, because if we would overwrite the entire EMMC, that would take us a few days again. So we just made sure that we modified as few blocks of the EMMC as we needed. But then once we had that done, once we verified that we had written it correctly, we could try booting it. And then we got a root shell on the device by just swapping the init script to something that started binsh. Got a video of that one as well. This is like the default output of the Linux kernel. Now, I skipped ahead a bit because the Lux, for some reason, takes a bit of time. You can see it's doing things with the encryption stuff in the kernel. Got a video here to demonstrate it as well. The LED is blinking blue by default. I'm gonna make it blink a few other colors as well. It's now red, green, to demonstrate that we actually had code execution on the device. And of course, now that we have access, we can also dump the actual Lux encryption key from the device. We think these are unique per device because it also encrypts the user data, but we're not entirely sure. If you try this, please let us know if you get a key that starts with the same characters. And now that we have the Lux key, we can just encrypt our partitions as well. So even for the newer version, even for the newer standard .fit, because we have the key, we can just re-encrypt our partition and keep booting into our own firmware. So we now have the key, we have the firmware that we can read and analyze. And we even have a test device with a root shell, which is always nice for security research if you have a device to work on. You don't just need to try things without seeing what the end result is. So, next up, vulnerability analysis. We didn't get to that. So as Dan mentioned, this ended up being like a week before the actual competition. And once we extracted the firmware, we found out that they have implemented most of the radio functionality in a few binaries. They were like 100 megabytes each or something, and parts of that were written in Rust. So we were like, we're not going to find anything here in the week that we have. We're going to focus on our other targets, make sure those exploits are as reliable as possible, and get those things ready, because we just thought there's no way we're going to be able to do this. We hoped for something really easy, but looking at the firmware that we had, we thought, this is not going to work. Now, for those of you wondering, did you responsibly disclose this to like the Lux project or AOTech? We didn't bother because for two reasons. First of all, the change that for the older version to the newer version that happened 4 years ago in 2021. It's been patched for 4 years already. There's really no, they need to update. That's basically the only thing that needs to happen. And secondly, Lux does not consider this to really be in their threat model. There's the commit message for where they originally added the check. It's probably not really readable, but they do highlight the fact that this is not in the actual Lux threat model. If somebody can modify your disk, then you need other measures to protect against that. And there might be other modifications that can also work like this. So we had a really simple one where we can just make a null encrypted image. But there might be other tricks that you can do, like modify, because you can completely specify the image that will be analyzed. You can just try to influence like the key derivation from the password, or maybe there's, because it's not an authenticated cipher, maybe there's ways you can modify blocks to get it to make changes to the underlying image. So left as an exercise to the reader if you want to try something like that, but I think that might be possible. In the Lux file format. And the way it should actually be fixed, the actual proper solution here is to not rely on Lux, but to use a kernel functionality called dmVerity. This is like a cryptographic hash over a partition, which means that if you try to modify any part of it, then it will just refuse to mount it or refuse to read it and panic when you try to access it. So if you want to properly secure firmware, if you have read-only firmware, you want to make sure that in your secure boot setup, it's not modified, you need to rely on DM Verity. Now, as a conclusion, what are our takeaways? So we think that it's a good thing that vendors are hardening their devices with measures like secure boot and removing debug features, because it also means that the user data on the device stays more secure. If somebody like finds your hub or you try to sell it to somebody else, it's nice to know that they cannot just copy your Amazon password or whatever from the device by just taking off the flash chip. But that also means that security research for us gets harder and harder. You need like hardware hacking expertise. You need to understand like the protocols, communicate with chips to actually analyze the device. And you need to find vulnerabilities in the secure boot chains, like cryptographic vulnerabilities and things like that. But we think it's good if this actually protects user data on the device. But it looks to us like AOTEC might have prioritized keeping their firmware secret instead of actually making sure the device is securely booting because they relied on encryption instead of authentication for the Lux image. Now, as I said, we didn't actually succeed in hacking this device. We have no remote attacks. This kind of attack where we modify the eMMC was not in scope for Pwn to own. But we hope it might help somebody else. I don't think it's a target again this year. I don't know why, because they didn't have many entries. But maybe somebody else really wants to work on an AOTEC smart home hub. And if you use Lux yourself, maybe this is something to think about, that your partitions can be modified by somebody who has access. And we're going to publish the details on our blog. They're not yet there, but they will be somewhere in the coming weeks. We'll publish our write-ups. Now, if you have any questions, please let us know.
Any questions, please raise your hand if you have a question.
Yes. Maybe it's a stupid question, but how do you read all the data with only one data line?
So the eMMC supports like 1, 4, or 8-bit modes. Of course, it gets a lot slower if you're in 1-bit mode because it has fewer channels to communicate over. But we can just tell it, hey, we want to communicate in 1-bit mode. And yeah, then it takes 2 days to read the entire eMMC, but it worked.
Let it run over the weekend and then come back on Monday.
Do you know if another team took home the 40,000 or?
Yeah, there was, I think, one entry. Maybe.
One entry.
Yeah.
They use a different approach. Which would be way easier than what we did. They also dumped the EMC, but they saw that the U-boot version was very old and had a trivial CVE into it. So they used that to get CodeXec to break secure boot. And I think the vulnerability they ended up using was also rather trivial. They spend a lot of time reverse engineering it.
Yeah, I don't think they published full details on that. No. But it was something like a cryptographic bypass. But that's all we really know about their attempts.
No.
But
no. We did hear a lot of other teams also fighting with this device. Also thinking, okay, this is going to be an easy target, and then being stuck on the firmware for weeks.
Yeah, I think I heard from this team as well that they had multiple devices that they tried to read the eMMC and they bricked and had to get a new one because I think they tried to do the desoldering approach.
Any other questions? No, then I would like another round of applause for Dan and Thijs.